This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. Stephen King's latest novel deals in horror. Not the evil of monsters and supernatural beings, but the horror that can ensue when people act with the best of intentions. The book is called 11-22-63, and in it, the novelist tells the story of a small-town teacher who goes back in time to stop one of the watershed events of American history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Author Stephen King joins us from our New York studios to talk more about it. Stephen King, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
First, tell us the story of how your hero, Jake Epping, a high school English teacher, actually goes back in time.
Well, he lives in a small town called Lisbon Falls, Maine, where coincidentally I went to high school and worked my first jobs in a mill. And he has a friend who runs the local diner where the specialty de la maison is Al's famous fat burgers, which people in town call Al's famous cat burgers because the price is so low that people can't understand how he can sell it. And it turns out that his friend Al has a time, he calls it the rabbit hole. It's a rift in time in the back of his diner that just sort of appeared there. And when you go through, you always come out at the same place. You come out in Lisbon Falls, Maine at 2 minutes before noon on September 9th, 1958. And at first, Al just uses it to buy groceries to sell in his diner. And then later, he gets the idea that he could actually go in the past, live in the past for 5 years, and save John Kennedy from being assassinated in Dallas. And he tries to do that, but after 4 years, he develops cancer and comes back and drafts Jake Epping, who's a high school teacher, to do the job.
What gives the book its creepiness and tension is this idea about the past not wanting to change. Events literally conspire against these characters. When they go back in time and try and meddle with things, sort of a series of coincidences, they get sick, they get harmed in some way. You know, a tree falls in front of the car. The car gets a flat tire. Right, exactly. Just all these little things kind of get in the way of them and the event that they're trying to change.
Right. And it turns out that there's a reason for that. And I don't want to give away too much. I just want to say that my real purpose in using that time window thing was because I think everybody at one time or another has had an event in their life where they've looked back and said, if I had changed one little thing, if I had gone left instead of right, if I had waited another 10 minutes before I got in the car, this terrible thing never would have happened. We've all got those what-ifs, and 1122 is very much a book that deals with that what-if.
Why did you want to take on this particular moment in American history?
Well, I originally tried to write this book in 1971. I was teaching school in Maine. And it was actually 11-22, but it was 11-22-71. At that time, 11-22-63 was our 9-11. I'm speaking as a baby boomer now. So we were sitting around in the teacher's room, and it was the anniversary of that date, and somebody said, I wonder what the world would have been like had Kennedy have lived. And I thought, what a great idea for a book. What if you send somebody back in time, and they are managed to prevent the Kennedy assassination, but my abilities at that time weren't fully mature. I wasn't ready to take on a project that was that big and that reality-based and that dependent on research.
Right, and there's an enormous amount of writing about the assassination, the conspiracy theories, Oswald himself, right?
Sure, there's a lot of that. But the other thing was, in 1971, that event was still fresh. And I think that would have been much too early for someone to write an entertaining novel about a tragedy that great. And in 1971, a lot of the people who were actually involved in the story of the Kennedy assassination were still alive. And I think that the wounds were a little bit too fresh then. So I'm, on the whole, I'm glad that I waited. Right now, I think the only one of the major players who is still alive is Lee Harvey Oswald's wife, Marina, who still lives in Texas.
I wanted to ask you about that because throughout the book, Jake is essentially stalking Lee Harvey Oswald. And you depict Oswald's life with his wife, his relationship with his mother, their community of Russian friends. What kind of research did you find about those kinds of things to create that dialogue?
When I went into this project, I knew very little about Lee Harvey Oswald. I was not even convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone shooter. Of course, I could have picked his face out of a lineup, and I watched him shot to death on TV 2 days after the Kennedy assassination, but I knew almost nothing about him. So I started to get books. First, I got the videotapes of all the documentaries that had been done about the assassination, including the Zapruder tape, the movie, the 8mm movie. And most of the things that are in the book, the things that Jake overhears or sees with Lee and Marina, are documented. They're part of the public record. And one great hurdle was the fact that I wanted Jake, as you say, to sort of stalk Lee Harvey Oswald. And he does that in order to make sure that Oswald is the sole shooter. He wants to prevent the Kennedy assassination long before it goes down to the wire at the Texas School Book Depository. But he needs to make absolutely sure, and so he moves on to Mercedes Street in Fort Worth, which is where the Oswalds live. So a lot of these people were real, but Marina Oswald could speak very little English, and I wanted Jake to overhear them. But that what he would overhear, even if he could find some bugging equipment, which he eventually does, is he would hear a lot of Russian.
Does this feel very different from the other books that you've written?
Oh, my God, it feels a lot different from the other books because there are so many actual happenings. A lot of the characters in 1122 are real people, and that was the challenge, but it was also the fun of the book.
Why do you think we are so fascinated with that period of history? I mean, when I think of the popularity of a show like Mad Men, it seems like we're having a moment where we're all, pop culture-wise, looking back on that fondly. I mean, in some ways it's ironic, but in a lot of ways it seems fond.
There's a degree of nostalgia involved. Mad Men is not one of my favorite shows because I think that it takes a view of the 50s and 60s that's strictly upper middle class. And I wanted to deal with people that were, you know, not in that citified culture. And people look back and they see a lot of bad habits sort of ratified. Everything from cigarettes and alcohol to the de facto and real segregation that went on at that time. And people look back on that, I think, sometimes, and they see a simpler, happier time. And I think this is something that goes on constantly. We redefine the moment of golden nostalgia in our past so that in the 50s and 60s, what people look back on with that same kind of wouldn't it be nice nostalgia, they look back on the roaring 20s, you know, the flappers and hip flasks and Pierce Arrow automobiles and all that. So now, for my generation, the 60s have become our roaring 20s.
This is such a big book, and you spend a lot of time in the late 1950s in writing it. And are you going to miss that period now that it's over?
I am. One of the things that happens when you sit down from the perspective of 2011 to write about the 50s and 60s, my feeling is one of total inadequacy. I'll never remember what it was like. I'll never be able to put the pieces together. And research will take you a certain way, but it won't cut it when it comes to the actual feelings and textures of those times. But the more I worked, the more time that I spent in the past, the more things that I remembered. And that was a pleasure. It was a nice, almost like vacation in the way things used to be. But I love the present, too. So it was great. It was a great vacation. What is it they say? It was a great place, but I wouldn't want to live there.
Right. A great place to visit.
That's it.
Author Stephen King, his latest novel is called 112263. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can hear a reading from Stephen King and more excerpts from our interview at npr.org. Another way the sluggish housing market is changing the way we live, the rise of reluctant landlords. People who want to sell their homes to pursue a job or relationship, but find their pride and joy sitting on the market for weeks and months without a buyer in sight. So would-be sellers often move on, and instead of selling their homes, rent them, which means dealing with tenants. Sometimes that goes well, and sometimes not so much. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
So here's the tough talk that realtors often tell homeowners these days.
This is the new reality. Our market is you might sell your home or you might not.
So Chicago realtor Frank McGuire says that means
there is a whole world of people who are unintentional landlords.
Unintentional, accidental, reluctant, never in the world thought I would be a landlord. That's the fate of many a home buyer trying to sell these days. Sometimes it works out well. McGuire's next door neighbor is a good example.
My name is Paul Williams. I live in Rogers Park, and I moved here due to a job change.
Williams, along with his wife and young daughters, rent a home on Chicago's far north side. They also own a two-bedroom bungalow in Oakland, California, bought at the height of the housing boom.
We bought it at just over $500,000, and last appraisal was at $260,000.
Ouch. Once they heard that appraisal, Williams says he and his wife decided not to sell, but instead to rent their home to a friend of a friend.
I'd owned rental property before and had almost a problem every month, and so was not very excited about the idea of becoming a landlord again. But we've been very fortunate to have a great tenant. Knock on wood, thus far, it's been very uneventful.
There's been a big jump in the number of single-family homes shifting into the rental market since the country's housing boom started to bust. Eric Belsky with Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says during the boom years between 2001 to 2005, about 700,000 single-family homes became rentals. The latest survey tracking housing units from 2005 to 2009 showed a significant increase.
2.3 million single-family homes flowed from having been owned to being rented. And they're not just being offered for rent, but they're actually occupied by renters.
In some areas, condominiums are the big market. Ron Abrams with the Chicago Association of Realtors says sellers still often test the market first and put their condo up for sale in hopes of getting a good deal. And many end up renting their units.
The good news for the owners or the reluctant landlords has been that the rental market has been so good that they've been able to cover pretty much all their expenses and just been able to basically go on with their lives.
Of course, some condo associations don't allow rentals or have certain restrictions. And sometimes it just doesn't turn out so rosy.
My first time being a landlord turned into a nightmare.
Jeanette Masterson says if she knew then what she knows now, she may never have become a landlord.
The only thing I knew was that if something was broken, I would have to fix it. I just assumed everyone would be a good renter. I approached it in a very naive fashion.
For about 3 years, Masterson lived in a two-bedroom condo that she bought for $173,000. After she married, she moved into her husband's larger condominium.
Originally, my condo was on the market for 8 or 9 months. A lot of showings, no offers. After we weren't able to sell it, we decided to rent it out to bring in some income to help cover the two mortgages that we now had together.
The rent covered Masterson's mortgage and assessments. The tenants paid all the utilities. They called often for small things and then wanted to break their lease. It turned into a legal quagmire and a battle over the security deposit. When the saga came to an end, Masterson tried again to sell her unit. It stayed empty for almost a year. A realtor helped her find a property management firm, which rented the condo right away.
We're losing about $600 a month.
But at this point, Masterson says they're just trying to minimize their loss, and they're able to do it with a lot less stress.
I'm not on pins and needles every day wondering if I'm going to get a call about something stupid. Again, as a landlord, that's something I had to accept. But now I don't have to worry about it, having a property management company working for us, managing my condo.
Masterson says her best advice to accidental or reluctant landlords, be prepared, because it's not an easy job. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. It's been a difficult and emotional week at Pennsylvania State University. The scandal involving child sexual abuse allegations and a potential cover-up is entering its second week. And yesterday, the school's football team played its first game without longtime coach Joe Paterno and lost to Nebraska. NPR's Jeff Brady was there.
Late in the fourth quarter, fans hoped Penn State would still pull off a victory. It would have been a sweet one after such a difficult week. But that didn't happen, and the Cornhuskers won 17-14. When the game was over, fans began a cross-stadium chant that has become a mantra for those who believe in the resilience of Penn State amid the scandal. Kathy Zimmerman says she comes to every Penn State game, and the atmosphere at this one was different.
It was a quieter, calmer day, I think, but I didn't hear anything negative today. Nothing. People just accepted the decision and were here to keep our dignity, I think, and the universities.
The decision she's referring to is the one last week to fire longtime coach Joe Paterno. The scandal happened on his watch. Many say he should have called police after a graduate assistant said he saw former assistant coach Jerry Sandusky molesting a boy in a locker room. Sandusky faces multiple charges. Two high-level university officials also face charges for not reporting child sexual abuse. Nebraska fan Brandon Holtman traveled here for the game. It says coming in as an outsider was a little uncomfortable.
To be honest, it felt different. It felt like I couldn't cheer my team. It wasn't right to cheer my team.
Outside the stadium, there were plenty of tailgate parties, even while the game was going on. With a chilly wind blowing, Penn State alumnus Karen Schuckman says it's difficult to convey to people who don't live here what this scandal has done to locals.
If you're not part of the Penn State family, you can't understand how this feels, how personally it touches you. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I know that that's true.
Retired school administrator John Glanz has a theory why. Penn State dominates the local economy, and the institution is a part of daily life for a lot of people here.
And having grown up here, I have friends, family, neighbors. They all work here. Everybody from the moment they build a building, they hire some more janitors and plumbers and maintenance people and computer people and everything else. So.
As the university has grown, so has the community that cares about it. Meanwhile, a criminal investigation continues, and the school is launching its own internal investigation. Penn State professor Dennis Murphy predicts more bad news.
It's going to be another tough week, I think. We know we have to move on. But it's there's still going to be things come out we don't know about yet, and I think it's going to stay tough for a few weeks yet.
As the marching band left the stadium Saturday, Penn State fans walked to their cars, a disappointing final home game behind them. Maybe next year will be better. Jeff Brady, NPR News, State College, Pennsylvania.
A good friend of mine runs a Marcel Proust reading group at the 19th Century Library in Providence, the Athenaeum. She's also a former milliner and had just been to see the fashion icon Daphne Guinness's show at the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. There are over 100 pieces of contemporary cutting-edge clothing in the collection. Afterward, my friend sent me this email. Woke up thinking about Proust and Daphne Guinness again, realizing that Proust writes from the intersection of modernity and memory, and that is the same spot at which Daphne Guinness gets dressed each day. A constant, lively juxtaposition of everything in life, served up on the surface of a tiny blonde. Though she once got dressed in Barney's New York window, Daphne Guinness is decidedly shy. Her attire includes personal armor, fingers bedecked with over-the-knuckle motorcycle rings in diamond pavé.
Oh, crumbs. Well, that used to be an earring, but I recycled it.
Waif thin, with hair striped both platinum and jet like a skunk's. On the day we meet, she has two rat-tail combs stuck in her upswept hairdo like a tiara, black leggings and towering black platform shoes with no heels, another of her signature elements, and an elegant white tunic.
It's beautiful. It's just a very old white dress.
that I've had for ages. This is an old Chanel piece. I'm normally late, so I just kind of throw on the sort of thing that's sort of at hand, and then I'll go through phases of wearing the same thing again and again and again. My wardrobe is mainly black and white, so sort of it goes together. I'll play with certain elements, but it's I don't really think too much about it. If I start thinking about it, that's when it goes wrong.
Not so terribly wrong. One historian's talk on the show was called Fashion Icons from Marie Antoinette to Daphne Guinness. Valerie Steele, FIT's director, is also the show's co-curator, along with Guinness herself.
I met Daphne a little more than 2 years ago at a luncheon, and within an hour of meeting her, I was asking her if she would do a show on her collection and her personal style. Because there have been so many shows about individual great designers, but very few about the individual women of tremendous personal style who are really the ones who make the clothes come alive off the runway and in real life.
They went through the clothes at her homes in London and New York. Guinness owns over 3,000 pieces. These were culled to about 100 couture garments in 6 different areas, like sparkle, exoticism, dandyism, armor. Daphne Guinness is an heiress to the Guinness brewing fortune. Her grandmother was the fascist writer Diana Mitford. She grew up partly in Spain. She was a tomboy, she says, and yet a bit fragile.
I don't know. I've always been rather slight, and often I've sort of felt a little bit like I kind of needed to be sort of like protected, especially with lots and lots of sort of rowdy brothers and sisters. And I always wanted to be a knight of the round table. It was sort of like it appealed to my sense of kind of the Gawain and the Green Knight. And mm-hmm. I'm afraid I still have a very vivid imagination.
What changed for Daphne Guinness was her emergence from the chrysalis of extraordinary privilege. She's in her early 40s. At 19, she married a Greek shipping magnate and quickly became the mother of 3. Then a decade ago, she divorced. Her fashion style emerged as avant-garde, fused with literature and theory. She might collect a vintage Balenciaga gown or a purple one-piece by an art student from Chicago and then put them together.
One acts as a catalyst between two artists or, you know, and then it's sort of like, well, let's do this and let's do that, and then it'll be a kind of natural thing. One's not very conscious of what one does.
It's an interior state of mind. A designer's coat worn backwards or diamonds worn on the inside of a collar, remaining unperceived to all but her. Some of her greatest inspirations were her close friends, the British fashion journalist Isabella Blow and Alexander Lee McQueen. Blow, known for her fantastical headwear, like a 3-foot-tall sailing ship, really wanted her friend Guinness to meet McQueen. But the shy Guinness demurred, preferring to admire him from afar. And then one day, in London...
I was walking across Leicester Square with the kimono on, and this person goes, "Oi!" And I turn around and he goes, "I'm Lee. I'm Alexander. I'm the person you don't want to meet."
McQueen's studio was a haven, she says, and they talked about their lives much more than about fashion. Those lives were not always easy. In 2007, Isabella Blow, ill from cancer, committed suicide. In 2010, Guinness was asked to persuade her friend, Alexander McQueen, to do a retrospective show in New York.
So I called him up and he said, "I think it's a bit soon for a retrospective." Cut to 6 months later.
6 months later, McQueen committed suicide. He was 40. His show, called Savage Beauty, opened May 2011 at the Metropolitan Museum and drew over 500,000 visitors.
Now, I live right near the Met, and having to see every day in front of it, I kept on just thinking, this is like a bad dream. I mean, this was just not supposed to happen.
McQueen may have been the designer to whom she was closest. He made her a gift of an opera coat of raven's feathers, an Edwardian jacket with solid silver life-size eagle epaulets. But she describes herself as a bee among designers who flies from flower to flower. And this world, seeing and admired by so many, says Valerie Steele, is nonetheless a vulnerable world.
That's what you're really appreciating when you're talking about the artistry of fashion. And it's not just the genius of one or another designer, but it's also a whole centuries of civilization that went into the craftsmanship that is expressed in the couture by all of the workers who are able to make things. And it's very fragile because that could disappear very easily under the forces of fast fashion. There's no need for it.
As in the sense there's no need for a piece of music, a painting, or a catsuit, a bodysuit worn from neck to toe. The British designer Gareth Pugh made one for her with nails, thousands of them, facing out like a porcupine. She'd sing it on the runway in Paris.
He called me up one day and he said, well, do you want the nails and the bum? And I said, yes, absolutely. He said, well, you're going to give yourself a lot of acupuncture.
There's no need for the extraordinary footwear she wears, which she swears are comfortable.
No way. I wouldn't wear anything that was uncomfortable. Stilettos are uncomfortable.
Yes.
But the heel is actually concealed in the shoe. It's an optical illusion. That now I can go on point.
And watching her walk on point is a bit like watching a water insect skate along Fifth Avenue. Guinness has famously said that she doesn't do event dressing because every day is an event, just to be alive, to celebrate, and to champion being an individual.
I mean, people just say, well, why don't you just go around in a pair of jeans or something? And because I don't like them. You know, I don't tell everybody else what to wear. I'd never dream of it. I mean, frankly, I would never judge someone else.
But of course the Daphne Guinness Show will be judged, and she's ready for it.
I have to do this because the context of so much of the history of these things has been lost, and there's a whole generation of students and children that haven't seen this. Mm-hmm. And for them to be able to see how things could be made and to be able to allow their imaginations to run and not to have to feel that they have to wear this or that in order to be accepted.
And then there's this. When she sees these clothes, these works of art, she sees the faces, the hands, and hears the voices of those who made them.
When you put on something of someone that you really love, it means so much because you think of that person, you think of the process. And when I go to look round that room, it's not about me. It's about lots of pyramids of people. You know, from the makeup to the hair and all the laughs that we had, is masses and masses of different families that one's part of. And that's what's so humbling, because it's not just me. It's a lovely network.
One felt that she did not dress simply for the comfort of the adornment of her body. She was surrounded by her garments as by the delicate and spiritualized machinery of a whole civilization. Marcel Proust never met Guinness, but now you have a chance. The show, Daphne Guinness, is up until January 7th. Be sure to check out her shoes. Smoot, a unit of measurement equal to 5 feet 7 inches, often cited when discussing the inherent arbitrariness of measurement units. After Oliver Smoot, whose height was used as the basis of the measurement. Smoot is one of 10,000 new words that are featured in the 5th edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language out this month. And yes, that's a print edition. Now, why in an era when every definition is just a click away, publish an enormous, big old book of words? For the answer, we turn to the dictionary's executive editor, Steve Kleinidler. He joins us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. And what say you, Mr. Kleinidler?
It turns out that people are still very passionate about their print dictionary. We did a lot of market research going into this. And what we discovered and what you might think might be the case is that people want it both ways, print and electronically. And for this edition, we've made it available in both formats.
And as we mentioned, there are 10,000 new words. A couple of them I've got here. Ollie, which is a skateboarding maneuver. Ono, which is a Hawaiian word for delicious. Another word that came up is spaghettification, the extreme elongation of an object by tidal forces as it falls towards an extremely massive astronomical body like a black hole. This is a new word, right? I mean, this is not a word that's been floating around science for a long time and we just didn't know about it.
It's relatively new compared to a lot of science terminology. A lot of words that are added have actually been around for a while. It's a rise to cultural prominence or some sort of resonance in the public discourse that would bring them into the limelight, as it were.
Talk about how you decide on the new words. What are the parameters? Who are the people behind those decisions?
We sent out a lot of our terminology to consultants. I worked with a legal consultant, a chemistry consultant, atomic physics.
And I read that you have this usage panel which was fascinating. It was just like the ultimate literary dinner party. Rita Dove or Jonathan Franzen.
The usage panel, which is headed up by Steven Pinker, is a group of about 180 people who use words for a living. They are either linguists or poets or writers or journalists. And with a more contentious debate over, is this correct? Is this incorrect? You know, how do you pronounce this word? Every year we send out the panel a ballot full of questions asking their opinions. And then the results from these ballots, we then frame into usage notes. For example, when talking about the difference between flaunt and flout.
What about words that are politicized, like waterboarding or anchor baby, which are also two new words?
The trick is to define them objectively without taking sides and just presenting what it is. And in some cases, you know, anchor baby is definitely a very charged, politically charged word.
I want to look it up and see what you guys did. I have the book here.
And do you? And I have the iPad app.
Okay.
I got it.
Yeah. Needless to say, you're beating me to it. But hold on.
All right.
I'm close. Wait. Okay. Anchor baby. You give me what you got there on the app.
A child born to a non-citizen mother in a country that grants automatic citizenship to children born on its soil, especially such a child born to parents seeking to secure eventual citizenship for themselves and often other members of their family. That took a long time to write. It falls into a gray area where we felt it was better just to state what it was, and then people can filter their own life experiences through the word and make judgments on it as they see fit.
Can you tell us some of the words, some of your favorite words that made it into the book?
There's a few cool things. I like what dog breeders now call a Mexican hairless dog is a Xolo Itzcuintle. And I like it because it's just spelled with X's and Z's. It just looks cool. X-O-L-O-I-T-Z-C-U-I-N-T-L-I.
This is a Scrabble word, definitely. Yeah, this is my new Scrabble dictionary.
Well, if you like Scrabble, here's a good one for you. Zij, spelled Z-I-J, another way to get rid of a troublesome Z, which is an astronomical text tabulating information on the positions and motions of the sun, moon, planets, and stars, especially a text written in Arabic or Persian in the 8th or 9th century.
Wow. Steve Kleinadler is the executive editor of the 5th edition of the American Heritage Dictionary. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.